Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loans subject to approval in available locations.
Hello and welcome to The Sci Guys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird, and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Jap, Luke Cutforth.
Hello!
And special guests, Ramon and Tim.
Hey! Ramon and Tim!
This week, we're talking about queer quarks and fabulous physics. Ooh. But first, we have a wee review.
Oh, a lovely wee review.
If you want to leave a review, head over to Apple Podcasts and leave one there. It's got to be a five-star one or it won't work. Don't test it, but it has to be a five-star one. This one says, thank you, Sci Guys. It's five stars. And it says, I rediscovered it and I'm hooked. I listen while I do art for college and I always feel so cool and smart. I listened to the asexuality episode a couple of weeks ago, expecting to learn more about my friend, but it opened my eyes and made me think about sexuality in a way I hadn't before. I felt silly, but everything suddenly made sense. And I realized I'm on the asexuality spectrum. All my life, something was confusing and I can't believe it took until now to make sense. But thanks to the Sci Guys, I finally understood. Thank you for everything.
That is so cool. What
amazing,
the heck?
Right?
Oh
amazing.
My god,
so nice.
And
wow.
The question almost tied into this little review. If you are listening on Apple or Spotify or anywhere else where you use your ears and nothing else, go ahead to YouTube. Use your eyes and your fingers to answer this question. Are you LGBTQ?
Plus.
No.
No?
No.
Oh, that's a surprise. I should probably tell Phoenix.
Don't tell my boyfriend.
Okay, let's start the show.
I'm Ramon Barthelemy. I am an assistant professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Utah, and all of my research is focused on equity, diversity, and inclusion in the fields of physics and STEM at large.
I'm Tim Atherton. I'm a professor at Tufts University here in Boston, and I study a group of materials called soft materials, and I also study physics education, and like Ramon, I'm particularly interested in queer issues.
Great. Perfect. I remember you telling us the kind of... Oh, Jamp told me the top line title of this episode, so now I'm excited to find out what happens and how this makes sense.
What was the top line title of this episode?
I think it was LGBT physics or something.
Oh, yeah, that was the...
I was like, how do you make physics gay? I don't...
Well, it's already quite gay. you just have to look for it.
So fantastic, great. Just up top, a question from me is: how do you kind of get from sort of studying physics into studying sort of physics education and moving into more of the sort of stuff that you guys are doing in this paper that we're covering today?
Yeah. So I think for me, I started graduate school studying nuclear astrophysics. But what happened for me was I ended up going to Riken, Japan, and working in a lab for a week, actually over Thanksgiving week, which is a holiday here in the States, when I was a first year graduate student. And the entire time I was fascinated by the cultural interactions of the people actually in the lab, mm-hmm. and I was much less focused on the actual physics. It was also very difficult to actually get involved in the physics in that setting because there were so many cultural barriers between being an American, traveling to a Japanese lab, multiple languages, et cetera. And I realized that my fascination was the culture. So when I came back to the United States, I started peeking around at like the other graduate programs that existed at my institution. And there was a science education program with faculty that were in the respective sciences. So my faculty member was in physics, obviously. And I talked to my advisor who was advising me for being a teaching assistant, and he was the professor of physics education there, Charles Henderson. And I was like, well, could we do like, you know, in this field, can you like study gender in physics? And he was like, well, I've never done that before, but like, we can give it a try. So I was like, okay, I'm going to do that. So that's effectively like what drew me into it. And at the time, there was actually no work on LGBT anything in the sciences. There was like one or two papers, because this is 2010. Mm. But shortly thereafter, I joined OSTEM, which was out in science, technology, engineering, mathematics. And with that, it started me down the road of actually doing LGBT studies in STEM. And now I would say that I do queer studies. And there is a differentiation between those two fields. Mm-hmm. But that is my villain origin story. So.
I like to think of myself as a force for light. But nonetheless, as you can probably tell, I'm originally English. I did my PhD in Exeter, actually, in the UK. And after grad school, I started looking for jobs. And so I ended up taking a job in the United States. And, you know, many years later, I'm now a citizen. And I would say, like Ramon, kind of that experience of kind of living in more than one culture actually really kind of made me realize, you know, like, although the United States and the United Kingdom share, like, approximately a language, almost nothing about our countries is the same, actually. And so you're constantly, like, navigating that. I love physics. I'm still doing lots of physics. I have amazing students. But what kind of started happening is, you know, because I'm also queer, I was at one point, I'd never actually met another queer physicist of any description. And I was like, I wonder if there are any. And, you know, eventually what happened is, you know, at conferences, gradually met a few. And, you know, one of them was the very talented Eleanor Long. Another was Savannah Garman. Another is Michael Falk, basically the co-authors of the paper. we started asking questions like, well, what are the experiences? I mean, we'd had our own experiences, which were, you know, some positives and negatives, frankly. But we're like, oh, we really need to do this systematically and rigorously and carefully. And so we got connected to, you know, this brilliant physics education researcher called Ramon Barthelemy, who had just started working on this. And I think that's kind of it, is that, you know, like, I've always been very passionate about enabling other people to do physics. And part of that has been, how can I make physics as a workplace, as a scientific enterprise, a place where more people, people who haven't necessarily been able to do it, or haven't been prioritized, I would say, to do it. So that's really kind of my journey, is that, like, you know, I'm passionate about education, but the thing is that it's not simple. And so we need to do, we need to treat research on education. We need to treat education as an intellectual endeavor that is kind of on a par with doing our science, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it needs the same level of rigor and thinking. And that's why we have, you know, collaborators and friends like Ramon, who are actually enabling us to do that.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I think you hit on a really interesting point there when you mentioned that there was a point where you didn't know if there were any other queer physicists. And I have to say that, I mean, my focus tends to be on sort of biology, usually, because that's what I studied at university. That's why SciGuys tends to focus on a lot of biology things, because that's where I'm comfortable. But honestly, when I saw, I think it was your tweet, Tim, that came up about this paper, and I was like, oh, wow, yeah, queer people in physics. That's something that I've never really considered before, because you never really hear about it. I mean, on the pod, we've had, we had Jamie Raines. A friend of ours came and joined us for an episode to talk about his PhD, looking into sort of arousal in trans men. And he was talking about how that was one of the first studies that had been done on trans men.
Yeah.
And especially one of the first studies that had been done on trans men by a trans person, by a trans person sort of carrying out the study. So it's really interesting to hear sort of similar things going on in the field of physics, where you can't really study necessarily the physics of gay people. Do you know what I mean? You can't study sort of queer physics necessarily in the same way you could do so in other sort of sciences. So it's really great to hear that this sort of thing is, there's really a push for that in areas where it's maybe less obvious to do so, you know?
I think it's what also comes down to a certain extent with all of the sort of archetypes of physics, like the so many years and generations of these, like, like it's like when you think physicist, you think this sort of stuffy, maybe borderline sexless, but definitely straight dude doing a bunch of math in Oxford University. Like, that's pretty much, like, there's not an awful lot of diversity.
In Oxford University, right? And that's actually one of the things that I, you know, again, so I went to Exeter. I didn't go to Oxford, right? I'm from a working class background, right? I'm not from a posh background. And that really shaped how I was able to do physics. Right. Mm. I didn't get into Oxford, right, or Cambridge. And as a result, a whole bunch of doors were closed to me and I had to move to a different country to do physics. Wow. So that wasn't do you know what I mean? That's not necessarily related to me being queer, but I think it's sort of really interesting that you bring that up immediately, that kind of like the, you know, the situatedness of physics in our culture really is shaping who is able to do it in the first place.
Yeah.
No disrespect to people who are at Oxford or Cambridge, of course.
I think complete disrespect to anyone.
Offense intended.
Derogatory.
No, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I think that's something that, I mean, we don't necessarily talk about on this podcast. We spoke about it on After Dark, our sort of private patron podcast that's just for our patrons. You know, the sort of concept of class really influencing what you can do.
Your opportunities in life,
I wouldn't have described myself as working class growing up, but definitely when I got to university, I could see a difference between me and my peers who, I mean, I was a first generation university student. I didn't have any preparation for going. Yeah, you were the same, Tim, then.
All three, fantastic.
This experience where you're in this world that you have absolutely no experience in. Everyone else seems to kind of understand what's going on and know what to do and have all of these cheat codes, and you're just there. Around all of these people that know what they're doing.
I remember walking home once with this guy from my class who I quite liked, and we were like walking back to our dorm area, and his small talk to me was, "So what stocks have you bought recently?" And I happened to have bought one Twitter stock, like, because I was interested in it. I was like, I bought a bit of Twitter. It was one stock. And so I was able to sort of jumble my way through the conversation. But it was just so clear. That's, I was so like, oh, funny. My God, you are in a different world. You're like 18 and you're talking about what stocks you bought.
I mean, we could even tie that sort of back into sort of LGBT queer aspect as well, because you could even point out that a lot of queer people are less likely to have a supportive family that is going to sort of help them through that sort of thing. They're less likely to have a support network. And even when you get to university, yes, there are queer sort of there are queer societies and things like that, but there's definitely a bit of a difference there in experience for queer people in comparison to maybe their non-queer peers. And that kind of, I guess, sort of brings us on to the actual paper that we're talking about, which I say comparing sort of LGBT people to sort of people outside that group, but that's not really what this paper did, is it? It looked just at the in-group. Do you talk a little bit about that, please, just for the people listening?
Yeah, absolutely. When we set up the survey, you know, with the American Physical Society and this ad hoc committee that had been created, really on the back of advocacy that was done by Elena Long, who's now at the University of New Hampshire, a nuclear physicist and great advocate and for LGBT issues in physics. I was really like following in the footsteps of, you know, like science studies scholars like Sandra Harding and, you know, people from Black studies, Black feminist studies, like Patricia Hill Collins, in that we want to catch people's double consciousness, right? So their experiences as both an LGBT person and also a physicist. And part of that is normalizing our experiences as the experiences that matter and not trying to compare us to other groups. So one of the big things that these, like, you know, early scholars did, Donna Haraway, Sandra Harding, Patricia Hill Collins, as I mentioned earlier, and really queer theorists like, you know, early Judith Butler and Michel Foucault and modern day, you know, queer theorists like Darius Bost and Roderick Ferguson, is really thinking about the lives of queer people from the lives of queer people and realizing that we can gain knowledge and information, both quantitative, right, this traditional gold standard of empirical knowledge, and also qualitative, actually talking to people and understanding their contextualized experiences without having to compare us to our non-queer, our non-queer, you know, colleagues.
Yeah, no, I mean, and that was something that I find really interesting in particular about this, because so often, you know, I mean, it let's say, like, to simplify science down a lot, you've got a control and you've got the thing that you're sort of looking at, and yeah. So often, you know,
straight people are the control.
So often, yeah, but genuinely, so often that's how it feels, and it was genuinely nice to just read through a paper that is focusing solely on this group that I'm interested in understanding the experiences of. And, you know, obviously there's this sort of section about terminology. Whenever we talk about sort of queer studies, there's always this talk of terminology, because, I mean, you both know this. I mean, I suppose we all know this, that terminology in sort of science in academia is not really catching up necessarily to sort of modern usage. Yeah. And I always like to highlight when there is that sort of section just for terminology, because it's very useful. Yeah. So, I mean, thank you for adding that in, because so often. it just isn't there. And you have people saying trans to mean something different than, you know, you would expect them to mean, or non-binary to mean something different than you expect them to mean. Yeah. And yeah, no, so I'm very glad that there was sort of that breakdown there that was...
One thing that's kind of crucial here is that the terminology is changing very quickly, you know, and like over the course of my career, you know, how we think about some of these terminologies and what is sort of the terminology that people tend to use has really changed over time, you know, and it's because we're talking about, you know, we're talking about it, you know, sexuality is at the core, I would say, of the human experience, you know, like it's a very complex thing. And it's not surprising that kind of, you know, trying to translate that into language is a very imprecise kind of act, you know, so it's not shock, and one that obviously is changing with time itself. So it's not shocking, I think, that, you know, that these things are changing. And as we're kind of understanding these issues better, I really think we are, in many cases, that terminology is kind of evolving, and we should ride the wave, you know. But, you know, as we're doing it, I think it is important that we try to record how we were thinking about things in the paper. And moreover, you know, we wanted this paper to be read not just by other physics education researchers, but by physicists in general. We really did. And so we recognized that many people might not be super familiar with these terms. So we really did want to try to capture them kind of for the benefit of our audience, in fact. Mm.
Language and queerness, you know, is so fascinating, because I think Tim, you know, is spot on with that. We're capturing language in this moment, because if you go back, at least in the United States, if you go back 70 years to the 1950s, you know, 80 years to the 1940s, that was when the word gay actually became an identity class. Mm, before that, gay or homosexuality was largely just an act. It was something that you did. It was not actually an identity. And what's fascinating in that is originally queer, at least in the latter part of the 19th century, early part of the 20th century, queer was the word used mostly by men who had sex with men to describe themselves. Gay was actually a descriptor of a location. So it was a code word that straight people wouldn't know. So like in a brochure, you would say it's a very gay beach. Oh, and wow. Straight folks would go, oh my goodness, what a lovely place to go. It's happy. but all the queer folks would know, okay, that's where I need to go. You know, so this is actually me pulling from the historical work of like George Chauncey in a really important book called Gay New York. But queer history teaches us that, you know, identity was codified later. And what's really interesting is homosexuality was invented before heterosexuality. So there is no heterosexuality without homosexuality. Because if you go back to like the German sexologist Hirschfeld and others in the middle like 1800s, you know, that's when the word homosexuality developed. And it was the development of the idea of homosexual that they then had to say, well, there has to be a comparison point. So what's the comparison point? Well, it's heterosexuality.
That's so cool.
And that's kind of one of those interesting things that pops out of queer history and queer studies.
That's really interesting because that almost parallels in my mind, if I hope I'm right on this, that transgender became a much more popular term before cisgender.
Yeah,
cisgender
yeah,
was
interesting, yeah,
despite
yeah,
the fact yeah, that yeah, trans and cis, obviously, yes, they come from, is it Greek roots, I think?
Maybe Latin.
This side of and opposite side of.
Yeah, is it? You're right. Yeah, the rise of the use cisgender is because you needed to give a word to something that was originally just taken as the given.
Absolutely. And I think what we were kind of touching on is something that we've kind of touched on previously on the podcast, in that, in sort of how language is updating to meet how people are sort of describing themselves. And, you know, so often you hear people say, there's all these new identities coming around, they're always popping up, this and that, but it's never new identities popping up. It's identities that people have had for a long, long time.
Yeah,
it's feelings that people have had forever. It's just now we are able to put words to that. You know,
yeah,
it's
new
it's,
ways to describe those feelings, getting more and more accurate, like more and more HD, is like we describe it sometimes on the podcast. It's going from a lower resolution understanding of A and B, you know, hetero and homo, cis and trans, to being able to find all the things in between that don't quite match either, or yeah.
Well, right. I would tend to avoid binarizing everything. Actually, that's something that I find very important. Yeah. It's like we shouldn't see everything as a binary, right? And I would also sort of say that, like, you know, I'm not actually sure that I'm gay in the way, like, you know, someone living in Britain in like 1910 say it was gay. Like, I really can't say, you know, like, I mean, I would have, I tell you what, I would have loved to have lived in Weimar Berlin. Actually, it would have been amazingly fabulous. I would love to, like, some of these kind of historical queer places are super interesting and complicate kind of our narratives of progress, I think. But you know, I don't know. I think of these words as people finding ways to express their experiences and who they are, you know, in the here and now. And to the extent to which they correlate with the other experiences of other people, I think that's a really interesting question. You know, like, you know, so I agree with you. I don't think these identities are new. But on the other hand, they may actually, you know, maybe they are, and that's great, you know, like, who cares? So
I think that this really gets to the idea of the social construction of identity, right? And that's like the big thing of queer theory, and really Michel Foucault's work, and even Derrida before that, about deconstructionism, which is where they take the identities we have and we deconstruct them, but we create all of our genders, all of our sexualities in a social construct. And really, you even have to take it like a step further, because when you talk about cisgender, there's really a difference between being a cisgendered queer person and a cisgendered not queer person, right? Or a cisgendered Hispanic person and a cisgendered white person, or a transgender Black person and a cisgender. Like, so when you start layering on the other social identities that we have, particularly with race, and then we also touched on class earlier, we realize that the spectrum of gender and sexuality is incredibly huge. And when you look, like, even in the United States, which I'm more of an expert in how we have categorized sex and gender in the United States, if you look at, like, early censuses and how we recorded people, there were inherently, you know, like, six genders, because they always said Black man, white man, indigenous man, you know, white man, etc. So when you count up all the race and the genders, there's actually six.
What?
And, you know, this is really drawing from my dear colleague, Dr. Catherine von Stockton's work here in English and Gender Studies, at the University of Utah, that has looked at, like, how gender is racialized, how sexuality is racialized, and how we never can actually disentangle these things because they're so interwoven.
It's really interesting that you say that, because we have, I mean, this is something that we were dealing with a little while back when we uploaded our gender dysphoria episode. It obviously resulted in a massive influx of people who up until, you know, sort of very recently had considered gender as this very simple binary thing that had no exceptions. And when faced with people that are, say, exceptions to their rule, they don't necessarily know how to deal with it. And they say, okay, well, you're wrong. my rule is right.
You're an anomaly.
You're an anomaly.
You're X, you're Y, you're Z, yeah, whatever.
No, I mean, it's really interesting that you sort of bring up that almost historically there has been more than two genders, even amongst people that would consider themselves potentially the same sort of gender. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But let's sort of bring it back to the paper, I guess. I mean, you talk about sort of you talk about standpoint theory in the paper, which I mean, I think this is the first that I'd heard of standpoint theory, at least under sort of that name. I might have heard of sort of the idea without knowing the name, but could you give us sort of a rundown of that? Because I think it was something that's really interesting and important to the sort of work.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I actually have another paper, not to cross the lines here, on critical race theory and standpoint theories in physics education research. Mm-hmm. So I have another write-up actually on this. But standpoint theory evolved out of essentially feminist movements in the 1960s and 70s in the United States. You can actually draw a direct line from a Marxist philosophy to feminism, because Marxism talks about class dynamics and class conflict and the proletariat and the bourgeoisie, and how if you want to understand the experiences of the oppressed, you have to actually talk to the oppressed. And standpoint theory took it up. Surprise! And standpoint theory took it a step further, because at the time, of course, when Karl Marx and other philosophers were writing about this, they didn't think about women, right? And they weren't thinking about race. So, and that was, you know, they weren't even thinking about gender as a binary, right? Like, they weren't even at that point. So standpoint theory really was about viewing women's lives and taking knowledge from women's lives and evolving from that. So the idea of standpoint theory is that you can talk to a collective of people from identity class, and you can create essentially like a collaborative and communal voice of that community. Now, of course, there's a critique of this, because you lose some of the details, right? So the topology of people's experiences gets normalized, right? So that is a big critique of standpoint theory. But it is a starting point to actually create discovery and knowledge from the point of people's lives that normally don't get talked to. And that was why it was really employed in this study early on. And it's what gave us the attitude and the idea to not have a quote-unquote control group. Mm. And unfortunately, a lot of people are still stuck on having control group. Tim and I just had a grant reviewed where they were like, why don't you have a control group? Because we're trying to do a follow-up study of this 10 years later. And we're like, well, maybe we need to describe this a little better, because the whole point is that we don't have a control group.
Queer people are not bacteria. Yeah. You know? Like, we're not like doing like a little lab experiment, you know?
Like... Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting as well, because this is something that's kind of touched on, I guess, is that when you try to compare, say, queer experiences to non-queer experiences, there's some cases where comparison isn't necessarily apt. You know, and you almost necessarily will then have to view one through the lens of another. And so often queer experiences are viewed through the lens of sort of more heteronormative experiences, which then limits your understanding of the sort of greater topic.
And that's a very interesting point, because actually what can be very interesting, and one of the reasons that I'm always so excited about working with Ramon and our other co-authors on this, is that when you start to deploy queer theory, when you start to look at things with the queer lens, this actually can shed new light on heteronormativity. It can actually shed new light on the heterosexual experience, right? So I think that, as you say, we often kind of see queers through the lens of the heterosexism. Reversing that actually, I think, is very productive. And it can help us... I think address some very long-standing issues in science. You know, for example, you know, we have it will shock no one that physics has a lot of trouble with gender, with race. You know, all of these things. A lot of things have been tried to address some of these issues to make physics more equitable, and many of them haven't really worked. You know, over decades, and the question is, why is that? I think that by deploying some of these new ideas that we're bringing, we can actually begin to scrutinize kind of, you know, rather than being wondering why marginalized groups are not participating or doing badly in physics, we can begin to ask, how is it that the majority, or how is it that this certain group of people are kind of embedded, and how is physics being kind of recreated as itself as a culture, mm-hmm. and how can we disrupt that so that it is, you know, it is a different and more equitable enterprise, you know. So I think kind of reversing that arrow is actually a very powerful way of looking at the world.
And speaking to what Tim is really talking about, you know, of course, is intersectionality, right? Is the idea that we can't disaggregate gender and mm-hmm. race and class and everything else from these stories. And then in this research, and in the paper, you see that really clearly, because when we look at, you know, harassment overall, it's 22% of the participants. So a little over 1 in 5 report harassment. But when you actually break that down by gender or being cisgender or transgender, it's completely different, mm-hmm. right? Our trans colleagues are 1 out of 2, 50%, almost 50% are experiencing exclusionary behavior or harassment, you know. Women and gender non-binary folks are experiencing it at much higher rates than LGBT men. And LGBT men were reporting it at the lowest rates, which was only not, and I shouldn't say only, because any harassment is not good, but a rate of 11%. So when we look at the transgender experience compared to the cisgender LGBT man, we see that it's a 5 times chance of being exposed to harassment, exclusionary mm-hmm. behavior. Yeah. So what does that say about the people who just get pushed out of the field and aren't even represented in our study?
Absolutely. Ding-a-ling-ling, is that the ad bell?
It sure is.
It's the ad bell.
Well, the ad gods have asked us to promote our Patreon on this episode.
Hell yes.
Thanks to our patrons over at patreon.com/SciGuys. You get SciGuys every single week. But if you become a patron, you can get a whole host of other things. What can they get if they join our Patreon?
An extra episode a month.
You can get access to our super secret Patreon podcast, After Dark. Just because SciGuys has ended doesn't mean the conversation has.
That's right. And you can also vote on episode topics, submit episode topics for the vote, and some patrons can just get rid of democracy altogether and tell us exactly what episode they want us to make. You get bonus clips, behind the scenes stuff, lots of cool stuff over on our Patreon. You should definitely go and check it out right now. Patreon.com/SciGuys.
Don't miss it.
I agree.
Let's start the show again. So this paper is one of three. It's the second of three. Is it not?
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about sort of the scope of those three papers and how they sort of differ?
Yeah, absolutely. So two of the papers are out, and Tim and I are working furiously on the last paper, trying to get accepted. The first paper looked at the qualitative experiences of the participants, and I authored that one, and that's actually in the European Journal of Physics. So in that paper, I categorized all the qualitative experiences of each participant, and then I gave examples and talked about them. So that paper was actually one of my pandemic babies. It was when it was something I did when I was locked in my house and had nothing to do. I was like, well, of course I'm going to sit here and qualitatively code all of these horrific experiences of people and write about it. What else would I do?
We're glad you did that, Ramon. You
know? Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
And then the second paper, which was really truly a 100% collaboration between Tim and I, as well as, you know, the important inputs of all the other awesome authors and a graduate mm-hmm. student that I have working here too, Madison Swertz. We looked at the quantitative stuff, right? And for better or for worse, the quantitative story is going to be more powerful than the qualitative story in the minds of physicists. Mm-hmm. But we wanted to make sure that we publish on everything. So in this paper, we published on all the quantitative results, but we also backed it up with a lot of the qualitative stories. Before I talk about the last paper, did you want to say anything about these papers, Tim?
I'm just going to sort of say that I think it's important to note this is all from the same data set, mm-hmm. right? That's sort of a key thing, is that all of these papers sort of stem from the same data set, but we're looking at the same data set in multiple different ways. That I really, personally, you know, I'm going to sort of disagree a little bit with Ramon in that, like, I think physicists do tend to like quantitative data, kind of that's sort of how they're programmed, you know. But when I've shown this to other physicists, I found that the mixed methods approach that Ramon kind of really forced us to adopt, I think that's been so powerful, because I think seeing the quantitative data paired with kind of actual human experiences, that has been really essential for people getting kind of the results of the paper, you know, because it you know, you can show people graphs and that's good, but you have to remember that that is, you know, that is actually, you know, several hundred humans' experiences that we're talking about, and kind of getting an insight into what that is sort of really crucial, I think, for the reader, for the listener, to kind of understand what's going on.
It's hard to emotionally connect with a graph, really.
Right, it's like the quantitative data sort of gets you through the hard outer shell of the physicist. And then once you're into the sort of mushy bit on the inside, that you've got the validity of the quantitative data, and you've got through that firewall in the physicist, and then you've got to the mushy inner shell of the physicist, and then you can put your qualitative data in, and then they're like... They're on their back, they're on their belly, the mushy part's exposed, and you can just be like...
Yes.
Yeah, it's like you've broken past all the stuff that they might filter out because it's not quantitative, and then you've brought the emotion and the human experience in with the qualitative.
Well, I think that's interesting because that's kind of what we tend to do on the podcast. So you two have definitely noticed that whenever we do a topic that's like, you know, our sort of trans episodes or even our ADHD episode, we really, really like to get in guests that have... personal experience, because data, obviously anecdotal evidence, isn't really evidence, but pairing sort of someone's actual experiences with data can be incredibly powerful and also shed new light on the data that you're looking at.
So I love that point, and just to summarize what we were talking about before, or to conclude it,
paper number three, Ramon.
Number three. But I want to go back to the anecdote as not data, though, because there's kind of a queer perspective on that.
I have a great quote for this. The quote is, an anecdote is data if it is recorded.
Fair. Ooh. Fair.
Told
That's
you, Corey.
Beautiful.
Go for paper number three.
Paper number three, yes. Yeah, we're busy. The reading room, the reading has begun today.
Yes,
so. No, I'm just kidding. No, I have props because shade is being thrown.
Oh, my Lord.
But paper number three.
Do you just keep that fan by to your desk? Really?
Ready.
I love that.
At all times,
yeah,
ready to go.
I keep a fan at my desk. Yeah, yeah. So paper three. is the purely quantitative paper. So we actually looked at data that we didn't analyze in the previous two papers or the report that came out years ago. And in paper three, we look at the workplace climate of participants and how that influences their consideration to leave as well as their outness. And what was really fascinating about this paper that's coming out, and you're getting the scoop here, is that when we built our statistical models, our regression tables, we actually find that positive climate is a more powerful predictor of staying than negative climate is a predictor of leaving or consideration to leave.
Wow.
So that's a really powerful finding. So that'll be coming out hopefully soon. We just submitted the last version of it to the journal. But what that tells us is that a neutral climate is not enough. A neutral climate will drive people away. Mm. What we need is an actively positive climate.
Yeah. That's so interesting, because I think I was talking about this maybe on pod, maybe off pod recently. I never remember what I'm saying where. It all blends into one now. This is my life podcast. This is my life. I was saying that this was probably in the late noughties, early tens, that tolerance was being preached. It was all about tolerance. You need to be tolerant of gay people. You need to be tolerant of people that aren't white. You need to be tolerant of people that are different from you. And I've always thought, a bit weird that you just want to tolerate us.
We put up with them.
We'll put up. I will hate you, but I'll be quiet about it. That's just not good enough. And it's really interesting and fantastic to see that sort of you've got data there that reflects that just tolerating a neutral environment isn't enough.
And I think it's not shocking. And I think, again, another thing that's very important about this study is that it has been done by queer people who are also physicists, right? Like, and so that's kind of, that's absolutely crucial to the design, because, you know, it's a very wide range of people on the author list. Mm-hmm. We're bringing the resources that we have from our lived experience to help us interpret this data. And, you know, so when I think about my own lived experience, you know, when I've been in climates where, you know, there are no other gay people, they're not visible, and you're just kind of like, well, you know, how should I act here? You know, should I, you know, and so generally kind of, you know, you're trying to pass. Everyone is trying to pass. I think that's what they're doing. You talked about kind of earlier when you're at university, kind of like, what is the game here? What are the codes, you know? And so I think kind of this sort of, what I generally refer to as like a chilly climate, you know, one where queer people are not necessarily visible or welcomed. It's not surprising that that gives very little traction for retaining people, right? Like, I mean, because you just don't know, is it safe or not? You know, you don't feel particularly welcomed. So I think this finding is really important, but it says it's just not enough to do that. We need to actually build these, we need to build a supportive climate.
Absolutely. And I mean, you kind of touched on something there that I think is really interesting, because I doubt you're aware of the goings on of micro internet communities, but there has been
tell us more.
I assume that you spend not all of your life online like I do, but from doing that, I've gleaned that there are people sort of talking online now about how it doesn't matter your identity, it doesn't matter what your identity is, the only important thing is data. That is the only important thing, and that rubbed me the wrong way slightly, because it was always coming from people who weren't from the marginalized communities that they were talking about. And the reason that they seem to be saying that is because there was pushback about them being the people leading the conversations online and these sort of internet communities. YouTube. I don't know why I'm saying internet communities. YouTube and Twitter, right? Yeah. That's what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And my thoughts on it were sort of that, yes, there is data, but data isn't sort of king. Data isn't above your own personal bias. Data needs to be interpreted. And who interprets that data and how they interpret it is incredibly important, almost as important as the data itself.
Yeah.
If you have, say, queer people interpreting the data about queer people, you're probably going to see something slightly different than if you have people from outside that group interpreting the data. And the same if the people that are sort of setting up the studies and running all of this, you know? So I'm glad that you sort of brought, you kind of touched on that there.
Yeah, and I would add to that, actually, that like there's kind of a persistent myth, I would say, that like data is somehow objective, which isn't really something that philosophy would support, you know, like virtually anybody, I think, who knows about it, you know, it's not, you know, and that science kind of is this sort of objective meritocracy. You know, these are sort of common myths I find people have about science. And, you know, when I'm teaching people about data, as I do as a physicist, I think it's very important for people to remember, you know, how is the data collected? Who is collecting the data, you know, and why? And this is equally true for particle physics data as it is for social science data, like the data we're collecting here, right? Because, you know, if you discover that your detector had some weird thing, you know, you need to know that in order to interpret the data properly. Just so kind of knowing who's collecting the data and why is sort of crucial for us here. So it's sort of, data is not a neutral object. It's immersed from some scientific process of inquiry. And, you know, that kind of the rationale, the collection process is actually fundamental. You can't fully disentangle that from the interpretive process. So that's putting my little philosophy hat on there, but whatever.
No, absolutely. I mean, I completely agree with you there. I think this is almost similar to the conversation we had last year with Ian. A good friend of ours, Ian, from the Dirtbag Boy band Bears and Trees, joined us to talk about their work studying first experiences with gay sex and sort of sexual scripting. And something we touched on there was the sort of difference in the way that people view qualitative and quantitative data, and how quantitative is seen as more valid or more data-y than qualitative, despite the fact...
More objective.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. More objective. It's how we were talking about how the difference is just in sort of the number of data points that you're looking at, right? With quantitative data, you're simplifying down to look at as sort of almost few variables as possible, whereas as qualitative data, you get so much more information, but actually then sort of trying to compare that to other sort of other bits of data is slightly more difficult.
Mm-hmm. Remember the nice, really rich, juicy data points with lots of stuff in it.
So, I mean, I think that sort of to say all of that is to say that, again, I really thought it was fantastic just sort of reading this sort of this paper that had a mix of both, because, you know, you could see the numbers and then you're reading all of these sort of quotes from these interviews, and it really hits you, you know, all of these stories in here. And I'd say to anyone that is listening to this, I mean, I know I always say check the references in the description, but I'm saying again today, go down and read this, because it's well worth your time, and I would definitely say to share it with anyone and everyone you can.
And there's actually interesting thing that you bring up, Corey, in terms of that. If you've got this, it's sort of similar to what you guys were saying about physicists and about physicists maybe you thinking that physicists won't care about qualitative data. Corey makes this comparison a lot of the time when we're talking about intersex people. So most people... you might have been brought up and you might have been lived in a world where an intersex person existed, but you might not have known the intersex person existed because either they're being sort of forced to living as one sex, or you just don't know, right? Mm-hmm. And then the statistic Corey always brings up, which is relevant to me, is intersex people are as common as ginger people. And that's really interesting, because ginger people are an obvious thing that you can see in the world. And that sort of opens the door to go, oh, okay, right. So if intersex people are as common as this thing that nobody goes, as Corey has said in the past, there are brown-haired people and blonde-haired people. These ginger people, they're just an outlier and we don't have to worry about them. Yeah. They don't fit into the group, and so we ignore them. They don't fit into the categories. And so when you then have to build this new model of sex to incorporate people who are as common as something obvious that you can see, ginger people. Mm-hmm. And then that then opens you up to hearing the qualitative data of those people's experiences, because they're no longer an outlier or a statistical anomaly that you just pass off as like, well, biology's trying to be male and female and everyone else is just an anomaly.
Jesus.
Because that's just not... Okay, sure. No.
Yeah. I do want to point out that, like, the intersex people in comparison to ginger people, it depends on how you classify intersex. I'm only saying that because I know there'll be people in the comments telling me that actually I'm dead wrong, but just... look into it, please, because it's not just pulled from nowhere, you know. So I mean, let's get back to the paper. I mean, we're going on so many tangents, it's almost as though it's the
point of the podcast.
The point of the podcast,
just
yeah.
A cool paper that opens up discussion.
Note that, you know, queerness naturally disrupts linear narratives, so
absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we've spoken through a lot of the paper. I think it'd be really interesting to kind of talk about your thoughts on the actual sort of the hard data, the quantitative stuff that's in there, because some of it is really, really interesting, because you were looking at the sort of percentage of people that were out. And I mean, this is something that that I found quite interesting, that you were looking at people not just being out, but out to friends, immediate family, extended family, mm-hmm. and co-workers, because those are all different things.
Yeah.
And that's something that's often missed when the person talking is not themselves queer, because it's not something that you would necessarily immediately understand, that it being out
you're
is not
out,
just
not.
Being out. Yeah. You know, so. You could be out to your co-workers without being out to your immediate family or extended family or even your friends. Yeah. You know, there's different environments. I think that's really interesting. I would just if there's anything you'd like to say about the sort of quantitative data there that stuck out to you.
I think one of the most powerful findings from that was the statistical significant differences between people who identified as people of color and people who did not identify as people of color within the data set. So part of the standpoint theory that we talked about is looking at differences inside of the group rather than comparing the group to an entirely outside group, right? And of course, one parameter is race. And we found that, you know, people of color were less likely to be out in the workplace. Mm. And then, of course, the question, of course, is, well, why is this? And we can't definitively say why this is, but the qualitative data points to some answers. You know, and in our qualitative data, I mean, we have a direct quote where someone talks about the fact that the race is the first thing that they see. And they're first getting discriminated against for that, and they don't. And one of our, not one of our participants, but someone once jokingly said at a session, I don't even get the opportunity to be discriminated against for being an LGBT plus person because everybody is too busy discriminating against me for being a person of color and being a woman. So I don't even get, I don't even have that privilege, right? It's a really warped way of thinking about privilege. Yeah. But, you know, we saw that in the data, and I think that that is really powerful.
There's one of the quotes from the interviews here that I think really sort of highlights almost exactly what you're talking here, if I could just read it out for you all. And I'll tell you this, I think I grappled more with the race element than I do with the sexuality, because the deal is that's what they see first. I can't actually closet my race because I'm evidently, I'm brown, my hair looks different, so it's just there. That said, I think there's already a prejudgment there on the basis of how high my aptitude is just in general. It doesn't necessarily have to be specific to physics, but anything that requires some level of critical thinking is always kind of under examination or assumed to be mediocre or subpar. And that one really kind of hit with me, because this is something that, like, to me online, constantly happens. I mean, and even in a sort of positive sense, because I find myself being praised for being articulate often. And I notice the differences in the compliments and the insults that my peers get. I'm told I'm going on rants when peers that are similar in passion and sort of in the way that they portray themselves. People that are similar to me, my peers, they don't get told that they're going on rants. My peers don't get told that they're very articulate, despite the fact that they are as articulate as I am, if not more. And it always feels it's never this thing that is outright said, but it always feels like, are you saying that I'm articulate because you expect me almost not to be?
Surprisingly articulate.
Surprisingly articulate, yeah. Exactly.
I've got to tell you, the bias works the other way. I play tennis with a dude who is well-educated, well-off white man. And when I had a conversation with him, he told me that the reason he voted for Boris Johnson, our current prime minister, is because he thought he was funny on Have I Got News For You? Oh. And I was like, that's, God, I thought that, like, my bias would have told me that you're quite smart and you're an idiot.
But then you got to think, if Boris Johnson wasn't, you know, a cishet white man, he wouldn't be able to get by just by...
Yeah, sure.
Like being funny on a TV show, you know?
He's more than that, right? Like, this is the whole thing about Boris Johnson, is quite hard for people outside Britain to realize, right? Like, he's from an aristocratic background. And, like, you know, people like Boris Johnson get away with, like, things that none of us would be able to, you know, if we did any of that crap, we would be, probably we would be deported, you know, like, you know, that's sort of the current policy. So it's sort of fascinating kind of how, you know, it's fascinating how, like, these complexities are intertwined, and kind of, you know, bringing it back to your question, you know, something, you know, years ago when I started studying these issues, I had like a picture of intersectionality when I first heard the word. I kind of thought, oh yeah, you can have different identities and we have them like in a basket and like, you know, there they are. And so I think one of the things that I have learned over the years, one of the things that I've learned as I've been doing this work and kind of, you know, is that you can't separate out these things, you know, like and they're really, our identities are sort of strongly entangled into, like, you know, like I don't know what a good metaphor is, but
an identity soup,
a soup, I guess. But you know what I mean. It's so hard to we can't and we shouldn't really try to. But you know, when we look at data like this, you know, we do. You know, we're seeing, you know, we're seeing very important links between comfort and outness. You know, we're seeing differences between white people and people of color in who they're out to, actually, which is really interesting. sort of speaking to kind of how support networks that might exist, you know, for different groups. Like, one of the things I think that's really interesting about this data is how many new questions it raises, actually.
Yes.
Like, you know, like, there's so much more that this is kind of linking to, and that work really needs to be done. You know, I mean, one thing that's really obvious is that this data was collected back in 2015. And it will not shock you to know that, like, you know, significant things have happened in the United States since then, and are still happening. And so, you know, do we reproduce these results? You know, do we see new things? You know, I think identity may even have shifted. These are all kind of really important questions that we need to get to. You know, one thing that's also good to know, though, is that the Institute of Physics, which is Britain's version of the American Physical Society, they recently did a similar study. One of the things that surprised me, actually, because, you know, as I've said, I personally don't see Britain and the United States as nearly being as similar as people think. They're really, really different places. Nonetheless, the British study actually really showed most, like, many of the same effects. It was very striking, actually. So, you know, I was surprised the degree to which these results held up between two rather different countries as well. So that's my take on this data anyway.
And Tim and I have been building off of this. So, you know, we're working on collaborative projects to really grow this. So we're still working on, we want to do a follow-up, a decadal follow-up of this survey. So we're working on getting the grant in motion and getting the funding to do that. I'm working on another project that Tim is actually on the advisory board for, which is looking at how LGBT folks, as well as women, PhD physicists, develop their professional networks. Because one thing that we found in this data set was that people oftentimes talked about being excluded from professional networks. I mean, there's lots of quotes about, like, I don't get invited to the dinners because they don't want to invite someone that has a same-sex partner, right? So in this study, we're going to interview 100 physicists and talk to them about how they build their professional networks. And then furthermore, Tim and I also collaborated on a really awesome grant that I'm super excited about, which is about queering the actual enterprise of science education research. And we're waiting on the results from that grant. But on that grant, we teamed up with other science education researchers and scientists at Tufts, as well as psychologists and people who do ethnic studies here at the University of Utah. So we're getting that, like, infusion of the humanities throughout the project, which is really cool. And, you know, I can also let Tim speak to some of the cool stuff he's doing at Tufts.
Yeah. So, no, we're so stoked for the queering STEM education project. I mean, that's so cool. One of the thing, I have a couple of things that I'm interested in. One of them is that, you know, there's a sort of very obvious question at the end of this paper, I feel, which is like, well, what do inclusive spaces look like, you know? And so, you know, for the past few years, I've been trying to create a very different kind of physics classroom. It's one where there's no lecturing. It's one that is, like, entirely group and project based. It's one that's kind of very grounded in the epistemology of physics. So it really tries to reflect physics practices, but it tries to do it in a way that people with marginalized identities can actually bring their identities to the classroom and even use their identities as resources for disciplinary activity. And as part of that project, it's part of a project called Remaking STEM. You know, we've taken extensive data on this and we're sort of analyzing it to kind of see how this environment is working. But I've actually seen quite a lot of evidence already that, you know, that some things in that are going very well. And we have examples of students kind of, you know, like, talking about physics, talking about doing physics in ways that brings in various kind of marginalized identities. So that's so cool. Another kind of question that's coming out of this paper, I think, is, like, you know, we're talking about consideration to leave. I don't know about your experience, Ramon, but I think many of the LGBT people in physics that I've ever known, and I've known quite a few over the years, almost all of them have actually left physics, I would say. And so, like, there's a really Great question. Like, well, where did they go? You know, right? And so I had a real moment of revelation, actually, because I did a gay running group here in Boston, and one of the other runners is a chemical engineer. He left chemical engineering as an academic discipline, and he was saying to me, he now works for a company. And he was saying that one of the things that was, you know, he realizes he had a very abusive environment. He had a very kind of problematic kind of experience, or at least he observed that. He was saying that you don't know what an inclusive environment looks like until you live it,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
That was really revelatory to me. So I think one of the things that I'm really interested in doing is seeing what kind of climatic experience did queer people who left physics have, and how did that reshape their views of physics? You know, I think that's kind of a really interesting question that, again, might shed new light on this question that, you know, both Ramon and I are very interested in, is that, you know, what would it look like for a physics that is inclusive of LGBT people?
And what's kind of interesting, like echoing on that, is I've quit physics multiple times, but wow. Somehow I have always ended back. Yeah, I've quit physics multiple times. And most recently, obviously, I have this faculty position here at the University of Utah. And Tim was a big part of that, because before this, I was actually working in the private sector. I worked at a company doing education consulting. So I'd travel around the country and talk to administrators and be like, here's how you can improve. And I had a conversation with Tim because we had stayed in touch over the years. And I was like, do you think I could be a professor? And Tim's like, yes. And let me help you put together your presentation and your papers and all this stuff, because there's all of this like cultural competency that you have to even be an academic. And it's this kind of like, you know, Tim always says that it's kind of like dating in the Victorian era, right? it's very arcane and Byzantine, you know, and you need these mentors and these supports, right? Mm-hmm. Which is why we're looking at professional network. And like, Tim is part of my professional network and part of my mentorship tree to support me in being a physicist. And, you know, if we take my anecdotal story as data, you know, it suggests that we desperately need queer mentors that can actually support other queer people to actually be in this world. And I'm sure it's the same for you, right? Like, I'm guessing podcasting is probably very straight, too. That's my guess, but I don't know.
Oh, yeah, I know. Absolutely. Yeah. Podcasting is one of those things. I mean, just being sort of on the internet in general, it's obviously gotten a lot better with a lot of different people. But you still see almost discrepancies between who is the most popular and who is sort of less than that. You know, there's let's say, you know, this is just one example, but there are two TikTokers that I'm somewhat aware of who are friends, who blew up at roughly the same time, and the one that isn't white, who does the exact same style of content with that guy, has far fewer, like noticeably fewer followers than the white one. And that's the only difference, because they're basically making the same content on both accounts with each other. It just doesn't necessarily add up unless you look at it through sort of that particular lens. I mean, this has been honestly a fantastic, fantastic conversation, and I would love to have you back at some other point in the future, perhaps when the next paper comes out. But we've got some questions from our patrons that would be great to answer over the next sort of 10 or so minutes, if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
Awesome. So the first question is, what are the barriers for trans people in science?
Oh, wow.
I think one thing that I will say immediately is that neither of us are trans. And so I want to be very honest and transparent that the absolute best people to answer that question are trans people. Right. So I want to sort of be very forefront about that. From our data, we're seeing a number of things. You know, firstly, we're seeing very increased levels of harassment and exclusionary behavior, which are very challenging. They need to be addressed. A second thing is that there are a bunch of policies. Some of these are US specific because healthcare works in a specific way here. It's not the same in the UK. You know, there's a bunch of policies that are kind of not universally available. Like health benefits covering trans-related needs. There are you know, issues of people using their pronouns, the correct pronouns. You know, there are a lot of things around comfort that are there. And I think the other thing is that, you know, there's, as we all hear kind of almost on a daily basis, the political climate in some parts of the US means that we're constantly hearing really horrific stories about the targeting of trans people for political expediency, I would say, by certain groups. So that is not an exhaustive list by any means. And I think it would be really interesting for you guys to actually have trans people on and sort of maybe speak to that in more detail. But those are some of the things that this support in our data. I don't know, Ramon, if you want to build on that.
You know, I think you spoke to the data really, really well. And I just want to point out that basic human dignities of being called the correct name, having the correct pronouns used, is such a fundamental barrier to participation. And there's also a huge barrier to participation based on the laws and the political climate of the states that you're in. So in my state, we just had a trans sports ban.
Oh, God.
In Florida, there is now the quote unquote don't say gay bill, which purports to only affect K through third grade, so very young kids, but really affects everybody. And I think most alarmingly, concerningly, and really terrifying is a new bill in Texas where gender-affirming care is now considered child abuse. Mm-hmm. And there's multiple other states that are trying to pass similar bills. So now trans folks really arguably are going to be unsafe in any of those environments. And if you're not a trans person, but you have a child who is trans, right, you could go to jail just for providing basic health care to your child. And that is incredibly terrifying. And I think this speaks to what we alluded to earlier, which is the nonlinear nature of progress, because queer history teaches us that things go forward and they go backward. And right now in the United States, I don't know how it is in the UK, we're taking a hard slide. You laugh, so that means something's going on. We're taking a hard slide. And like, to make a historical reference point, someone's like, point this out, you know. In Utah in the late 1800s, women had the right to vote and then lost it and then didn't gain it again until, you know, the early 1920s. In New York City, it was easier to be a man who has sex with men in the 1930s than it was in the 1950s, because in the 1930s, there were not as many people looking for you and trying to police that behavior. Yeah. It was still happening, but not at the same levels as in the 1950s. Mm. So I think we're in a very dangerous point in history now, a very concerning one, and we have to keep the pressure up. Oh, Tim had something to say. Oh, and
yeah, yeah. So when I was being interviewed actually for this, about this paper, I was speaking with a journalist, and I was talking about, I mean, those of you who are in the UK will probably know about Section 28. I grew up in the 90s, and I attended school in the 90s. There was this law that basically made it illegal to mention homosexuality in school, which is kind of shockingly similar to this thing that's just come up in Florida. Very chilling. I'm going to say that I was very lucky. I actually had a teacher who broke the law to mention, like, to talk about it in class. Wow. She actually, like, just flagrantly broke. And I didn't realize, like, how kind of lucky I was, actually. Like, yeah. You know, that there was this teacher, like, you know, she was quite young. She's younger than I am now. And she was just like, whatever, you know. So I think I was surprised that the interviewer actually didn't know about Section 28. Right. Even though she was English. And I think one of the sort of the dangers is that, like, queer history can actually be quite easily vanish and be erased, you know. So we shouldn't be assuming that progress is forwards. We have to constantly kind of, I think, fight to be for these things.
I was saying this the other day, and just to put this in perspective for anyone that doesn't necessarily know too much about Section 28, that was still in place when Luke started school in England. Wow. That was still in place when it was still in place in England when I started school. It wasn't in place in Scotland because it ended just the year before I started school in Scotland. This isn't ancient history. Yeah. I mean, it's people are living today who experienced this. It's something that's so easily forgotten about. And I think that a part of that is kind of what you're both talking about is almost the sort of, I feel like it's almost a complacency. Like I kind of point to marriage equality in the US being a sort of a key moment in sort of queer history, because you've got marriage equality in the US, and now a few years later, everything seems to be getting worse. But a few years after marriage equality, what was being said? Well, you're equal. You're able to marry now. It's fine. What's there is the no issue? Homophobia, but there is none of this. And now transphobia in the UK has reached a sort of fever pitch. In the US, these laws are made to be harmful to trans people, to make trans people not exist. And the same is going in Florida with the Don't Say Gay bill, where they think that by not mentioning just gay people to children, that the children won't end up gay. And inherent in all of this is the idea that being queer, being LGBT, being anything that is not this norm is inherently wrong or vulgar or in some way perverted. And it's just, it's at the very least, it's grating. And I mean, it has been driving me nuts for so long, just watching all this unfold.
And, you know, the other thing too is like, as scholars, if these don't say, quote unquote, don't say gay bills, you know, start making their way up to higher education, which is the target, right? We have the First Amendment to protect ourselves, but it all comes down to, it will come down to the Supreme Court. People like Tim and myself and many other people, I mean, basically everybody that works in any kind of ethnic studies, Black studies, Latino studies, AAPI studies, gender studies, queer studies, we all have to be prepared to lose our jobs. Because if these kinds of laws come to higher education, which is their goal, I mean, they have said this before, it would essentially outlaw the kind of work that we are doing. Things were bad when I was in graduate school. Like, you couldn't talk about LGBT stuff, and now you can talk about it, but now we're under threat of being sanctioned and losing our livelihoods and ability to conduct scholarship because of it. It's a very scary time. It's a really scary time. And I think, me personally, I plan to keep fighting. And if I lose my job, I lose my job.
Yeah. I mean, that's honestly an inspiring thing to hear. I mean, another question from our patrons. I feel like most of them have been answered throughout the course of this podcast. So I guess one final question from our patrons would be any advice that you have got for getting into queer research?
Oh, what a lovely question. I think Tim and I probably both have answers for this. So it depends on what you want to do. Do you want to do research like in the academic setting or outside the academic setting? So I'll speak to the academic setting a little bit. But if you want to get involved in the academic setting, you know, whatever degree program you're in, start looking around on campus for faculty that are doing this kind of work, right? Or even nonprofits that are doing this kind of work, and just cold email them. But first, read about their work. But when I get students that email me and are like, hey, I read your paper, I thought it was really cool, can I come work for you? Because these findings were nifty and I'd like to work on it. Those are the students that I'm immediately like, yes, I want you to work for me. And yes, let me try to find money to pay you. I'm pretty good about finding money to pay folks. And I think most people in the sciences we're pretty good about finding, like, shifting resources around to pay students to participate with us. So I would just, like, cold research out to faculty to see if you can get involved.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. Is that, like, if you're in university, that's the optimal time. And, you know, I would say even if it's not your main focus, like, it's still worth kind of getting involved in these things. Like, it's a very broadening and kind of wonderful and affirming kind of activity. I know that both Ramon and I have been, you know, we are immeasurably better ourselves for doing this research, you know, like, you know, as queer people in physics. Like, I think it's honestly one of the things that has kept me sane, you know. So I would say absolutely reaching out to people. And to even think expansively, because the infrastructure may not exist, you know, at your university, looking kind of around at places it does, As you're thinking about graduate school, you know, that could be a thing to think about. You know, the other thing that you can do is look out for research studies to participate in. This is another very important thing, like making your voice heard. I think also kind of one of the things that's really good is kind of making, like, articulating needs, you know, like what, like Ramona and I organize like a lot of meetups at conferences and stuff for queer people, kind of, you know, a lot of this research was driven by queer people telling us kind of what they thought the need was. So kind of telling people who are already doing queer research what you think the needs are, I think that's kind of a really helpful way. Like there's so many ways to participate in research. It's not just kind of necessarily doing it. But, you know, if you're also part of an organization, like thinking about doing a climate survey, you know, could be a really great way to improve your organization's inclusiveness. You know, like research can mean many different things and it can have many different outcomes, you know. So, you know, our outcome was to publish a scientific paper. You know, we've done a climate survey in our department that is not going to be published, but certainly has shaped how we're thinking about doing things. So I would say, like, you know, don't think about research as kind of one simple thing, though that's wonderful to participate in academic research. I think there's really a goal for queer people organizing and studying and articulating their own experiences as well.
Fantastic. Well, thank you both so much. I'm honestly upset that we can't go for even longer.
I mean,
this has been fantastic. I mean, hopefully, as I've said, we could have you on again, perhaps to talk about something you're working on.
We'd be happy to. Yeah.
Yeah, but thank you very much for joining us. Is there anywhere you'd like people to find you, a sort of social handles or anything like that?
So you can find me at Ramon Barthelemy. I also have a website, which is perutah.com. So if you want to email me or check out my research, you know, feel free.
On Twitter, I am Soft Matter Theory. Because I'm a soft matter theorist, because of the length of Twitter's handles, there is no E. So I'm kind of, I sound very Cornish, you know, like Soft Matter Theory. It's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing. I have some Cornish heritage. That's why I say that. You can also see, you know, you can also, if you just Google Tufts Physics, Tim Atherton, I'm pretty easy to get in touch with there. And we love hearing from people. We would love to hear from people who have questions about the study. We would love to hear ideas. We absolutely love engaging with the queer community, both in and outside of science. So we welcome your input and thoughts.
And if there happens to be any undergraduate physics majors that want to do a PhD doing this kind of work, come work for one of us. We would love to have you at our university. So email us and apply to our institutions.
Fantastic. Well, all the links for all of that will be down in the description. So definitely please go and check that out. But thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, Tim and Ron, for joining us. That was fantastic. Oh, but I think there's one thing left for us to do. It's a quickfire quiz.
Dun, 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 dun. Fabulous physics edition.
The rules for the quickfire quiz are the same as always. I will ask one question. That's one question only between the two of you. The first person to buzz in with the correct answer wins. What do they win, Jamp?
A queer quark. Just one.
Luke, what is your buzzer?
Ba-choo!
Jamp, what is your buzzer?
That's a good buzzer.
That's a good buzzer.
Buzzer. Yeah. Fantastic. Great buzzer. Okay, so the question today is, which laws prohibited the promotion of homosexuality in schools in the UK up until 2000 in Scotland and 2003 in England and Wales?
That's a good buzzer.
Jump.
Section 28.
Ding, ding, ding. Hooray! That is correct. Here is your queer quark.
Oh, it's so tiny.
Yeah, you can't see it.
Where is it? Oh.
There you go.
It's in superposition.
Not anymore. It's in my tummy.
And that is it for us this week. But before we go, we'd like to thank all of our patrons with a very special thank you to executive producers Rosa Rodriguez and Denito. And thank you for listening. You can find the full references for this episode down in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Monday. And why not leave us a nice wee review? You can support the pod at patreon.com/sideguys, or you can find and contact us at sideguyspod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and at sideguys on TikTok too. Or you can send us an email at sideguyspod@gmail.com.
That's sideguyspod@gmail.com.
Sideguyspod@gmail.com.
You can follow me at NotCorey everywhere.
You can follow me at Jampkin everywhere.
You can follow me at LukeCutforth everywhere.
And you can follow Ramon and Tim at their Twitters down in the description. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.